My name is Rick Kleffel, and welcome to Fine Print. Our guest today is Glenn David Gold, whose first novel, Carter Beats the Devil, was one of the best hardbound books of last year and has just been released as a trade paperback. Welcome to the show, Glenn.
Hey, great to be here.
Carter Beats the Devil is a historical novel set in San Francisco around the turn of the 20th century. It's based on the life of a real magician, Charles Carter. Now, what made you choose him as opposed to other better documented and known magicians?
Well, I think you've answered the question right there. He was basically unknown and undocumented, and so he was a blank slate for me. If you wanted to write about Houdini or something like that, there's such a paper trail that you have to compete with. I thought it'd be interesting to try to start with somebody that no one had heard of.
So that gave you a way to keep your fictional invention of the character colliding with the real-life person upon whom the character is based?
Well, let's just put it this way. I didn't think a lot of people were going to bust me for what Carter was or wasn't in my book. There are a few people. After I started writing it, there's a coffee table book that came out called Carter the Great by Mike Caveney, and it was a exhaustive examination of the real Charles Carter from birth to death. And it came out in an edition of about 1,000 copies, and I think that it was published at $100 or something like that, and it was just for magicians basically to read. And that's my competition. I mean, there's that's all of the paper trail for Charles Carter that there is. And so if you don't have that book, that there's nothing for me to really worry about.
Now, your novel mixes historical fact and fiction to create a really riveting story.
Oh, thank you.
Did you enjoy taking liberties with history?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, completely. I wrote this book at UC Irvine, the fiction writing program down there. I got my MFA. I was a graduate student there. And I'd never tried to write historical fiction before. I've read very, very little historical fiction. And I didn't really know what the rules were. And so right before I started, I went and I talked to two of my professors. And I asked them, what are your responsibilities as a writer? What are your responsibilities to history? And one of my teachers, who was very kind of Teutonic and grim, she said, "You must stay with the facts. Otherwise, your readers will find out and they will burn you at the mill with the monster," or something like that. You know, she was very, very much about obeying every single, coloring within all the lines. And then my other, Jeffrey Wolfe, who was the head of the program, he mentioned Robert Coover's The Public Burning, which ends with the Rosenbergs being electrocuted in Times Square while Richard Nixon and Uncle Sam have sex. And so I figured if that was the outside boundary of what I could do with history, then probably whatever I did would be okay. I mean, there's going to be readers who know something about the era and who want you to present exactly the facts as they are. But I hope that since what I'm writing about is magic and misdirection and illusion, that people generally do get the idea that what I'm writing about is a kind of history as magic trick that puts together fact and fiction to come up with an illusion that's appealing enough that you don't feel like you're being thrown out in the middle of the street when things don't actually add up the way that history probably did.
So you actually found that you were influenced by the technology and the gadgetry of magic in the way you constructed the novel.
Oh, sure, yeah. There are a couple of really great books, maybe not for a layperson, but for anybody who's interested in magic theory. There are books written by Maskelyne and David Devant. I think it's Jasper Maskelyne. There's a whole family of magicians. So there's Neville, I think Sir John, and Jasper Maskelyne. Around the turn of the century, they put together something called the Egyptian Hall, which was one of the great London places to go see magic. And they had a book that came out called Our Magic, which is what is their theory behind magic. It talks about dramatic unity. It talks about misdirection. It talks about how magic as an art form should have its own narrative behind it. And a lot of things they said made sense for fiction, too.
Well, that's really interesting. Now, how did the world of real magicians here in the 20th century greet the publication of this novel about magic?
Oh, boy, I was really nervous about that. I'm not a magician. I can't do anything whatsoever with cards, with coins, with anything. I'm a clod. And when I was working on the book, I tried to talk to a few magicians about it, but they're by necessity a closed society. They keep their secrets pretty close to their chest. And I called the Magic Castle, which has a really terrific magic library. That's a club down in L.A., and they weren't really very interested in letting me into their library since I wasn't a magician, understandably. When I was finished with the book, I sent it to Mike Caveney, the guy who had written the big coffee table book on Carter the Great. And I was extremely worried about his reaction since he knew the real Charles Carter so well, and since I'd taken such liberties with his life. And Caveney, you know, he called me back after 3 weeks, and he said, Mr. Gold, this is Mr. Caveney. Open your manuscript, please, page 428. Stage left should be stage right. Other than that, good job, you know. and Mike was my ambassador to other magicians, and I'm very happy. Stan Allen over at Magic Magazine had me come and speak to his convention in Las Vegas last year to 800 working magicians, and they've basically magicians have really taken on the idea of the book as a magic trick, that it seems to let people into their world, while at the same time has fudged enough details or makes some details feel real that aren't quite real. So I'm still maintaining some illusions there.
So the book, in showing it, in purporting to show us, the book is actually performing a magic trick, and what we're seeing is an illusion, though it feels quite real to the reader.
Well, I'm glad it does feel real. That's what I hope to do, yeah.
Now, there's a lot of technology in magic and a lot of technology in this book. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about technology and the way it impacts entertainment, both in this novel today and in magic in general?
Sure. The one quotation about magic I didn't use that I kept coming back to is that one that any form of technology, if sufficiently advanced, is indistinguishable from magic. And Lord help me here, Arthur C.
Clarke.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay, that's who I thought it was. And to me, there's something that's quite interesting about that. Magic in the turn of the century was. Let me go back, step back here for a minute, because it's actually a fairly deep thing in the book. People in the turn of the 20th century did not know what the difference was between a magic show and a type of gas that could eat your flesh away. You know, there were things that were put out on the battlefield that seemed completely impossible. Radio waves seemed impossible. X-rays seemed impossible. So why not have a device that you could talk to the dead with? No one really knew where technology left off and the imagination took over. And there's something sort of comforting about magic in that case, because it shows you that there's still some places the imagination can go where technology can't quite get to. And I think we're in a similar place today, whereas we have the internet, we have cloning, we have, you know, when we hear about these new wars that are going on, there's these technologies that just seem completely suspicious. I mean, who would believe that such things are possible? And I think that that's, in a way, why there's sort of a resurgence of belief in things that aren't exactly traditional stage magic, but are, you know, UFOs and a lot of the kind of the trappings of spiritualism and things like that that come along on the heels of technology.
Sure, the sliding scale from Uri Geller to the a real magician who's
mm-hmm.
just doing some sleight of hand. Now, your novel has a really interesting mix of feelings. Mm-hmm. On one hand, the overall attitude of the novel is very sunny and positive. It's upbeat. It's got a big smile on its face, and it puts a big smile on the reader's face. And part of the reason it does that is because while it's doing that, it's describing illusions that are really grim, where somebody is being torn apart, eaten by two lions, and two lions are running around. It's very grim, yet at the same time, you know that it's just an illusion. On the other hand, the technology behind the illusion could go bad and actually injure somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So there's layers of grim and happy. Was that intentional? Could you talk
completely,
about it?
Completely, yeah. I wanted to put a whole world between two covers. I'm quite a fan of when you read a novel feeling that you are absolutely full afterwards, that you understand a whole world has been presented for you. And my world, what I live in, there's an awful lot of joy and wonder and hope. But it's not, you know, I was going to say it's not the Disney version, but even the Disney version had quite a bit of darkness in it. If you go back to the original Snow White and things like that, I believe that the only way you can really feel you're not being sold a bill of goods and just like a big smiley face painted on something is if you've seen the darkness behind it. So, for instance, I mean, there are some overwhelmingly wonderful things that happen in the book, but also Carter accidentally kills his wife. The president dies in the beginning of the book. Carter, as a child, is tortured. And then there's some things that happen to him quite permanently by the end of the book that I don't really want to give away. But you go to some very, very dark places in the book, and I think that's one of the reasons why the joys, when they come, feel real, is, you know, I'm not snowing you, you know, I'm not ignoring some of the nastier things that happen in the world.
Well, you're very successful in creating that world. One of the feelings I got of reading that book, it reminded me of both Caleb Carr's The Alienist and also numerous science fiction works where the author is engaged in the real process of what's called world building, where it's building up a whole world. It seems the world that you create at the turn of the century seems very foreign. It's almost like something out of a science fiction steampunk novel where some technology was lost. Could you talk about a little bit more about the process of creating that world, all the history, the technology?
Well, that's terrific. Thank you. I'm not too familiar with that. I am not up on science fiction the way I would like to be. Although the novels that I felt the most simpatico with were the ones where you felt like Dune, where there's a whole world being built, or even Nine Princes and Amber in there, where you have a whole universe being built and there's kind of rules and they feel like they make sense. For building Carter, I started with what's the cover of my book, which is a real 1920s magic poster. That was my entryway into it. That was my tarot card, right, that led me to the rest of the pack. I just really wondered what kind of a person would have this as a business card. And once I started to decide on a personality there, I did all the research into what magicians actually did, what technology they had at hand. And I lived in San Francisco and Oakland at the time, and so I did a lot of research into that era. And I was always a fan of the 1920s growing up. I was living in the 1970s, and yet I was more fascinated by the Marx Brothers and vaudeville and things like that than I was in what was going on right around me. At a certain point in the, I don't think this gives too much away here. During the last weeks of his life, President Harding actually was stopping people on the street and asking them, what would you do if you knew of a great and terrible secret that would tear the country apart? And then he died, and he was never autopsied. And from that fact, there were so many possibilities of what he was talking about, so many secrets, so many scandals in his administration. I basically picked one. And it was one that related to an inventor in San Francisco who really was a 17-year-old Mormon farm boy who had come up with a device that he thought would end war. And it sounds so preposterous at this point that something like this could actually have existed, and yet it absolutely did, exactly in the form that I talk about in the book. And I was interested in the idea of there being a technology that can be viewed by so many different people in so many different ways. And like Carter thinks it would make a great magic trick. Corporations who have it think it would be like something to sell to the masses. The inventor thinks it's a way that's going to end war. And it's actually the most mundane object possible. And it is all those things that those people believe, and so much less, and so much more. And so there's something about that. When you introduce, you know, something that nobody has ever seen before. Actually, it's funny you should mention science fiction. There's a short story, and I can't remember who wrote it, where a person is put into an alternate universe where everything's exactly the same, except no one's ever heard of a paperclip before. And so he invents the paperclip, and people just think he's the most amazing genius of all time because now they have something to put their paper together with, and they never had that before. And there's an idea of you have, you know, one object can seem so alien when you really get into it. And so that's one of the things I kind of wanted to explore, is this completely mundane idea that becomes so much more than it starts out as.
Now, you mentioned this novel grew out of a thesis that you were writing at Irvine. Could you talk about the writing program at Irvine a bit?
Oh, yeah. Best writing experience of my life. The UC Irvine Fiction Writing Program, they let in 6 people every year, and 300, 400 apply, something like that at this point. I'm not really sure. And you have 2 years to sit around a table with the other writers and come up with a thesis. And every week people turn in work, and you go over it in workshop and critique it, and then go back and hone it and rewrite it and work on it and try to come up with something to make it better. And I was lucky enough to be in a class with other people who were just really terrific critics and really terrific writers, and they improved my writing immeasurably. It was one of those crucibles they talk about where you come out of it a much better person and a writer than you did going in. So I'd written four really awful novels beforehand that will not be published, that were not going to go anywhere. And while I was there, I had one of those quantum leaps into being a better writer.
We're here with Glenn David Gould, the author of Carter Beats the Devil on Fine Print. Glenn, could you talk about, you're married to Alice Sibbold,
Yes, I am.
and could you talk about the experience of having two incredibly talented writers in the same house?
Yeah, two incredibly talented writers, and we're pretty darn handsome too. It's great. We met on the first day of the program down at UC Irvine, and we got together very soon thereafter, and we had a relationship that was based from day one on the idea that we wanted to publish and that work was the most important thing. And that set up a rhythm in our relationship that I think is very handy, is that we have kind of complementary feelings about what's important and mutual goals and career aspirations that work out pretty well. I think what a lot of people, what I think I would like to hear is that, we turn over the furniture in the living room and launch Molotov cocktails at each other, about, who got a better review or better sales or whatever. But I have from day one loved Alice's quirky, insane self, and I'm just really glad that the world has more than caught up with me.
Now, before you wrote Carter Beats the Devil, you were writing for television and the screen?
Oh yeah, that's on the back of my book. I should deflate that. It's one
Okay.
of those things where when you turn in your biography and it comes out, you edit it and re-edit it and it comes back and forth and you can't really see things clearly. Let me just debunk that a little bit.
Okay.
I live in Los Angeles, and if you've lived in Los Angeles and you're a writer for over a certain number of years and you haven't written for television or film, they ticket you, and so I chased that tiger for a while. I had a couple of screenplays that just kept on getting optioned and optioned and optioned and almost made and almost made. I made a good 300-400 bucks off of those over the course of 7 years. And then I wrote this I wrote this script about lesbian biker chicks and the men who love them, and it got me a job as a staff writer on 101 Dalmatians, the animated show with Disney. They felt that I could handle character based on this, and that lasted for, yeah, that lasted,
Lesbian bikers to 101 in Dalmatians.
yeah, Pongo and Perdita immediately, that seemed to really just come to mind there. Well, the guy who hired me got fired the next day, and they fired me too, and everybody else he had hired. So that didn't last that long, but out of that, I also ended up writing an episode of Hey Arnold for Nickelodeon, and Alice and I wrote an episode of Recess for ABC together once, and that's the big giant set of credits that I have there. So,
Well, did your work in episodic TV have any impact on the way you wrote Carter?
weirdly, it did. Yeah, Carter's in three acts, and the big thing in screenwriting, you have Act One, get your hero up a tree, throw rocks at him, get him out of the tree, the three acts of screenwriting. And I taught screenwriting down at UC San Diego for a couple of semesters. I really loved teaching the class, and I really love writing screenplays. I'm a bad meeting taker, though. I'm one of those really, really grumpy, screenwriter guys who just grouses about all the meetings and things like that. So I love the format, and I love watching movies. And there's something about the predictability of three acts that I wanted to play with and play against. And it was a good way of breaking down a big book. It was a 750-page manuscript when it was done. And so to be able to break it down into smaller chunks allowed me to think about it and really feel like I could contain all these acts as stories on their own.
Now, has it been optioned for a screenplay?
Oh, yes, it has, actually.
And
Yeah.
are you writing the screenplay?
I certainly am not.
Oh.
It would be like chewing the same stick of gum again. I say that now. At the time, I really played with it for a while, and then they called me and said Robert Towne was wanted to write the screenplay, and Robert
Wow.
Towne wrote, Chinatown,
Sure.
and I thought I'd have to be the biggest jerk in the world to say no, I'm gonna write it. No, he and there's a he he's writing it with there's a young writer named Michael Arndt, Arndt, who's doing the draft of the script, and Robert Towne signed on to direct, and I couldn't be happier with that.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Now, can you tell us a little bit about what's coming forth?
I've got an article coming out in a couple months in the new GQ on obsessive collecting. I have been in my life an obsessive collector of you are shaking your head here. You're putting your head
You're
down.
talking to a person who has probably about 3,000 books carefully wrapped and covered, and just they're falling out of the shelves.
May I recommend Werner Munsterberger's Collecting an Unruly Passion, a book by
Okay.
a psychoanalyst about what it all means, if you can really look into that heart of darkness.
Don't know if I want to
You
know.
see, most people don't, but I collect comic book artwork and old Jack Kirby, Incredible Hulk stuff and things like that. And I ended up writing an article for GQ about that very, very strange and small world. And that's coming out in a few months. I'm doing the final edits on right now. And then I've got a story coming out in the new McSweeney's. Michael
Well,
Chabon edited a genre issue.
what genre is it?
Yes. Well, before I say that, I should explain. Originally, when they said genre issue, I thought, "Hey, ghost story." So I sent in, Michael, I'm going to write a ghost story. He's like, "Great, he's a good editor." He's like, "Great, that's wonderful. By the way, here's a list of people who are writing ghost stories. It's like Stephen King, Neil Gaiman." I thought, "Well, okay. As in Robert Towne is going to write the screenplay. There's
Right.
certain things that you just, stay away from there." And by the way, that's the second time I've said Robert Towne is writing a screenplay. It's Michael Robert Towne and Michael Arndt. I've become hyper aware in Hollywood that writers don't ever get exactly the full credit they should get. And so anyway,
Well, I'm well aware of that too.
yeah. So anyhow, I'm going to write a serial killer elephant story instead, and that's there, based on a true story.
Well, that sounds fantastic. You,
Thank you.
animals play a big part in Carter too. I was going to ask you, did you research lion keeping, elephant keeping?
I've always wanted to have a pet lion. I thought that would be interesting. And the real Carter really did have a lion named Baby. And I read some of what he wrote about it. I read what Anton LaVey wrote about having a lion in the house and how once you had a big cat, you can never really go back. And there's something extremely attractive and seductive about the whole thing. No, I didn't read a great deal about it because it did seem like at the turn of the century, if you had a pet lion, you had a pet lion. To me, the biggest, the one of the small things that didn't make it into the book, among many things, was that I remember in Oakland in the 1920s, they did pass a law against owning lions and large livestock, which made me think that before then, people just happened to have them as pets. And I sort of wanted to be in that city council meeting for a while about the debate about whether to allow people to own lions or not. I thought that would be funny, but it didn't really advance the plot very far.
Well, there's actually, even as we speak, they're looking for a lion or a more than one lion in Tennessee. They
Really?
took down a number of cows in Tennessee. They were sighted near a town. They're trying to figure out where the lions came from.
Oh, I love that.
So lions are not unknown as pets and not unknown to escape. Well, we've been talking with Glenn David Gould, author of Carter Beats the Devil, one of the finest novels of last year.
I love hearing you say that. Thank you.
This book is so incredibly easy to recommend to people. Let me tell all our listeners that you cannot find a better book to buy and recommend for your friends. They'll all love it. Thank you very much, Mr. Gould.
Thank you. It's been wonderful being here.
All right, thank you.